Welcome back to this week's episode of Toys on Tap. This week we bring an incredible artist, Recollection or Recollection Toys. You've heard his name both ways, but he makes incredible toys out of porcelain, the tip top of ceramic. If you want more Toys on Tap, you can like, follow, subscribe, rate, review wherever you get podcasts. You can jump on all socials at Toys on Tap. If you want to support the podcast, you can jump on the Patreon at patreon.com/toysontap. That way you can get access to episodes of the Nitty Gritty, which is 10 to 20 minutes with every artist that has come out. We would love to have your support, and we thank you to those that have supported us. You can also jump on the YouTube channel. You can subscribe there, like, comment, share, do all the things you know you do. Now let's get to this week's episode of Toys on Tap. Is this the whole studio right here?
Yeah, this is my studio. It's the disaster right now for multiple reasons.
No, it looks
where
great.
I come to work.
It looks like what a studio should look like. Like anyone that has a workstation that's not beat up or like it doesn't have stuff everywhere. It's like, is it even a workstation?
I know, right?
Yeah,
I don't know. It's it's like it reflects my mental capacity at any particular moment.
Yeah.
So like when it's cluttered, it's like that's how my brain is at the time.
Yeah.
And then when it's really neat, I feel like there's room to think a little bit more.
Yeah.
Kind of weird. But yeah, so I just moved houses. So like right now there's tables and clutter and molds and everything that I just crammed in here. I'm going to spin you around a little bit. Yeah, just pretty random at the moment.
Yeah.
We went from a house that had two double garages where I just could store everything to like none. So we're scrambling.
Yeah. You never, you know, like in, I live in San Diego. So houses that have garages are already non-existent unless you live in a neighborhood. And, my wife is like, we live in a one bedroom like cottage. And so she's definitely like, hey, like just watch what you have. Like just be careful. Because if I have ever a house with two double garages, I'm going to take one of the double garages.
So true. So I
get that. But that's crazy to go from two down to nothing. Almost nothing is crazy.
I mean, it's a bit, so my wife is was an event planner. So one half of our garage was just full of party supplies.
Yeah.
And then I've been doing this a long time. So I've built up like a lot of molds and artwork and crates and stuff. So and that worked those... out. But we also lived in a tiny cottage. So like our house was small. It was one bedroom.
Yeah.
But for some random reason, it had two garages on it.
Yeah. The dream. Yeah. What's crazy about what you do specifically, which I can't wait to talk about, is at least for like a normal toy maker where we're using silicone molds, over time those die, or like if they're broken molds, we don't need them, or like, but yours, it seems like you're going to save those forever. What are you going to do with
them? So I use plaster to make my molds. And over time, probably they last about 50 castings.
Okay.
And then the detail starts to wear down.
Yeah.
So they don't last forever.
Okay.
Especially
that's good
the
to know.
Popular ones.
Yeah.
Like Boba Fett, I've made him a few times.
Yeah. Well, we're going to talk all things what you do because you are the only person that does what you do in this toy scene, at least that I've seen. Please tell us who you are and what you do.
Oh, yeah. My name is Jeremy. I'm known on Instagram as Recollection or Recollection Toys. I make porcelain toys. So it started off as a project to remake all of my action figures, my action figure collection from my childhood, like the 80s.
Mm-hmm.
And then it's sort of morphed and grown and gone in different directions. But yeah. Still do it.
So good. It's so good.
And I started like around when everyone else like of this crew did, like during the lockdown.
Yeah.
It's just one of those activities.
What's crazy about this is you started kind of in the same way that most toy people start. It's like you see something, you're like, I want to start building this, or can I make an action figure? Yours remind me of like, I've seen you, it's almost like I've seen videos of you kind of playing with yours, like as you're making it, like you're showing what it does. Which
I mean,
is,
you have to, right?
Right. But then in the back of my head, my grandmother had a room of like porcelain dolls. And it was like, as a kid, I'm like, what are we going to do with all these? And she was very adamant, like, they're fragile. Don't touch them. How dare you? Mm-hmm. But I see your videos and you're like showing how it moves and all that stuff. And it's like, God, my grandma would kill you. What are you doing?
That's funny. I think a lot of us can relate to that. I mean, The grandma collection of figurines, same with me. I had that too growing up. And I feel like, this sort of merging of two just totally different things, but very similar at the same time. It's like a thread that's happened through a lot of my work. And it's just strange enough in the toy world that it kind of stands out a little. But
you say a little, it's like it stands out so much.
It was
much.
Not planned. Like I did not have this planned from the beginning. I just started doing stuff.
Man, it's great. But before we get to what you currently do, we got to figure out how you even came to a love of toys, which usually takes us back to childhood. Where does this love of toys, what toys did you grow up with? What are you doing as a kid?
I mean, pretty average. I don't think I'm that different from everyone. I grew up in Canada. I'm from Vancouver, BC. Mm-hmm. So I spent most of my life there. And it's a different country, but obviously we're affected by our neighbor to the south. So I had all the He-Man. I had G.I. Joes and Star Wars and all that stuff growing up. Watched the cartoons. Played with it. So it was a big part of my upbringing. But I wouldn't say I was like a toy nut. Like I was never like the kind of person that would collect stuff and keep it like pristine or anything like that. So I just played with them and then they disappeared at some point. Parents gave them away and I moved on to other things, Nintendo and stuff. But it was important enough that, so my daughter was born during lockdown, like in September of lockdown, and it got me thinking about like my childhood more and more.
Yeah.
And that's sort of where this recollection project started, was like looking back and remembering those times. And obviously it was nostalgic and it was like a lot of this other stuff going on, but I was already working in ceramics and mold making. So just shopping on eBay became pretty regular, and I picked up all my old toys. And then I just kind of stumbled into this scene, because obviously it's a type of bootleg that I was doing, and once you hashtag that, like, it all come up.
It's crazy.
Stuck it's Lord like, and yeah. like everybody, right? And then it's like down the wormhole.
I'm glad that you keep saying your name too, because whenever we talk about your name, it always comes up recollection.
How do I say it?
Recollection, which is it makes sense though. Recollection makes more sense because you're trying to recreate all this, like what your old collection or what you had.
Yeah, that's the premise, but it also has to do. So it's on one level, it's kind of a stupid pun, but I mean, recollection is all about memory, and then remaking my collection is what I'm doing. So I don't know. That's just what I come up with.
When
you're thinking Instagram handles, it's like, I've got to think of something.
Yeah. And then what's crazy is there are people that have switched their Instagram handle like halfway through. And it's like, what are you doing? How do you do that?
I know.
Like, just stick. If it's bad, it's bad. It is what it is.
Yeah. So I'm sticking with it. But
yeah. So you have all those toys. And I mean, when I deal with artists from other countries, it's usually easy to be like, hey, what toys did you have? Canada, it's so hard because you guys had the same toys. It moved upwards. It moved down a little bit. And so to ask you Like, oh, did you have these? You did. You had specific ones that we had. So
essentially the same. I mean, we did have some Canadian content in there, but it's like, US culture is so overwhelming. And Vancouver is like right next to Seattle. So
yeah. Wait, let's talk.
Like barely any difference.
You said you had some Canadian stuff. Is there specific like Canadian toys that you had that we don't have?
That's a good question. I haven't really investigated. I mean, GoBots? Were GoBots in the States?
Yeah. Yeah, that's like the initial competitors for Transformers and stuff.
Yeah, but I feel like they made it everywhere. That's a good question. I'm sure there is Canadian toys that are out there that I haven't researched. There's a cool store in, I think it's Victoria, BC, mm-hmm. called Cherry Bomb. And they have the Canadian Toy Museum that they started of their whole collection.
Okay.
I bet they would know. I'll hit them up.
Yeah, I might call them because that's crazy.
Yeah, check it out. They have an awesome Instagram.
Yeah.
Cool store.
The toys that I find in the U.S. that other countries didn't have aren't because they were U.S. specific. It's because they were so stupid. So it's like
the bad bootlegs from Mexico and stuff.
Well, even
or just
worse,
like their own toys.
Yeah. So it's like Cyborgs was one. Like during the whole rise of this four brothers, animals, whatever, Mattel and Hasbro were like mixed animals, mixed people. It's like Cowboys and Mumesa, Street Sharks, Ninja Turtles, all these things. There was one that like slipped in there, Cyborgs, and it didn't really go worldwide. And it was these like.
Was it from the States?
Or I think so.
Country? Okay.
Or it's like the Mighty Duck show where these like actual ducks are playing hockey and they're like crime fighters. That didn't like take off as well as it probably could have if it was not overshrouded by TMNT. But those are the ones that are, it seems, primarily US based. But it like. Not because of anything other than not popular.
I'm trying to think of TV shows because these toys are often connected to cartoons or kids shows. And, you know, there was like our Mr. Rogers was called Mr. Dress Up.
Okay.
He used puppets and like did drawings and would like have a tickle trunk, it's called, where all his costumes were.
That didn't age well, huh?
No. But there might have been toys that like connected to that. Yeah.
That's so crazy. The tickle trunk. I hate that. at some point along your life, you get rid of all your toys. And it's usually, especially, I don't know, how old are you?
Oh, God. I'll be 50 in July.
Okay. So that means you probably gave up your toys somewhere around the invention of like the first gaming systems or something, or you just grew out of it. When did you make your first comeback to toys? Pre-pandemic, or was it like pandemic? That was the first time you started.
Yeah, it was pandemic.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Like I didn't know anything about, I knew that there was a toy culture and I knew about vinyl toys and I had friends that were into them, but resin toys, no clue that that existed.
Yeah.
In terms of like collecting Star Wars and stuff, no, I never did that.
Mm-hmm.
So this is all rooted in like my, like, you know, 30 years ago or whatever, more.
Yeah.
40 years ago. And then, yeah, so it was all about like my experience. And then I'm interested in like ideas of collection and memory and nostalgia and stuff like that, but not really a toy person until recently.
Yeah. I get really scared in thinking about collecting. I'm really into the show Hoarders.
Oh yeah,
and so it's like I'm nowhere near a hoarder, but I feel like I have that tendency inside, especially if it comes to toys.
Mm-hmm.
And so that scares me. That scares me so much.
I feel that. Although collecting toys is different than hoarding. Like collecting is like very specific.
Yeah,
I think it's different for everybody, but it's not just like I feel like hoarders just take anything and everything.
Yeah,
and there's definitely psychological issues with both, or there can be. But yeah it's a slippery slope. I have a ton of, so when I started like digging into all these artists that make all like the resin toys, just, I love so much of it. So spent a lot of money. I called it like my research collection.
Yeah. 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 My research. Yeah, for sure. I one of my volunteers at my job, he is a tax person, and he's so like, I should have never met him, because he was like, listen, turn Toys on Tap into a business, and then the toys that you buy become write-offs.
Right.
And I was like, oh, that's dangerous.
Yep.
So now that's like the stuff behind me, that's now all write-off material, which is super great.
It makes sense.
For you, when you are like, we're into the pandemic, you already have a like this ceramic and mold making background. Where's that come from? If that's what you were already doing, how did you get into that? And because that's a very specific job.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, I like that you called it a job. So I went to art school.
Yeah.
Not a lot of people don't call being an artist a job, but it's a lot of work. And that, so I did my undergrad in Vancouver.
Yeah.
At a school called MLA Carr. And then I took some time off to do some artist residencies, traveled to Japan and Eastern Canada, and then went back to do my master's degree in Western New York. So for a number of reasons, I mean, going back to grad school, like changed the whole direction of my practice. But, and it was a weird time. It was like, I started school and then 2 weeks later, September 11th happened, and I was in New York in a new country.
Yeah.
And like my whole world was just crazy. But so, I mean, the cliche is that in grad school, they tear you down and then build you up again.
Mm-hmm.
And it was only a 2-year program, but it was so intense. And there was a lot of like self-searching and just figuring out your voice and stuff. Mm-hmm. And that's kind of where I developed sort of the mold making and casting aspect of my work. And pushed it forward into a lot of different areas. So coming out of grad school, I was doing really large scale porcelain sculpture and installation. Installation is in taking the gallery space as like the frame and then filling it up. And then like the viewer that comes into the gallery becomes a participant within the piece. Then making it all out of cast porcelain, found objects. So that I did that for a while, and I lived off of part-time teaching and a ton of grants. I got pretty good at applying for grant money and did that, and then traveling around to artists. Do you know about artist residencies?
I've heard of some of them. I don't know how it plays out in all of the areas.
So the thing about ceramic residencies is that they offer artists time and space and the facilities that are really hard to put together as like a solo person.
Mm-hmm.
Like renting a space, buying a kiln, getting everything together is hard when you're fresh out of school.
Yeah.
So I did a lot of residency hopping, and they're all over the world. I did one in Japan, in Korea. The Netherlands has a really good one. And these are places that are, some are just dedicated to ceramics. Some are ceramic oriented, but then they invite other artists like architects, jewelers, dancers to come and work in clay.
Mm-hmm.
There's one, this is what brought me to, I live in Montana now, but there's one in Helena called the Archie Bray Foundation, which is a brick factory that shut down and was kind of taken over by ceramic artists.
Yeah.
Like 60 years ago. And then over the years, they've gotten funding and they've become this like internationally renowned art center for ceramics. And they bring in 10 full-time artists every year. They give them studio space. They give them kilns and like a really good community to make work in. And funding. They pay for it too.
Yeah.
So this is like the dream situation where you can travel the world, make work, meet people. And I did that for like a long time.
Yeah. Which is incredible. Like the things that I know about a residency only come from like TV shows. It's like, if you win this competition, you'll earn a residency at this place. And the people all freak out because it's like their niche thing. They're like, oh my God, that's prestigious.
Yeah, yeah.
For the listener, it's like I'm sitting on the couch like, awesome. Like, okay, move on. But to have a place where it not only gives you a space to work, it gives you funding, which is probably the most important part. And then the creative community to kind of push back or like sharpen you as you do that. That is an insane like way to function for your first couple of years.
It's a pretty good mix. So you meet a lot of people, you get connected and see a lot of different ways of working.
Yeah.
And the ceramics community can be pretty small and not as small as the resin toy community.
Yeah.
But it's tight, you know? And, last week when I texted you, I was just coming back from Richmond, Virginia, where they had their annual ceramic conference, which is kind of like a version of VCon.
Yeah.
So it's like a bunch of friends getting together.
Yeah.
And there's lectures about like whatever the hot topic is. There were a few on AI this year. It's more geared towards education than VCon is. Like, so there's demonstrations of techniques and talks, panel discussions, and exhibitions. It's kind of a crazy ceramic circus.
Yeah, which is cool. I love the idea that they have, instead of just, like, VCon is really cool because everyone's selling things, but to have a learning component, like, oh, if you want to learn how to do some of this stuff, if you want to learn the history, go to this room. Like, that would be a cool dynamic to add.
Ceramics is so interesting because somewhere like, it's called NSICA, that's the conference.
Yeah.
And they draw people who are from just like a hobby community center, just learning, to students, to people who have been doing it for like 50 years. And then, of course, there's like an academic component. So a lot of professors go with students. And so it's like a really broad spectrum of people and interests, from sculpture to pottery to you name it. It's kind of crazy.
How do you fit into that? Like, because you do something so specific and it's to a niche that doesn't, like, probably a lot of people even over there don't do this. So when you tell people what you do, what's reception like? Are they pumped about the fact that you're making such intricate work?
Well, the reason I don't know exactly is because when I started the Instagram, I kept it anonymous. Like, my name, I'm not the face of it. My name isn't attached to it. So, and I built up a whole different audience than the ceramic world. And I loved it. Like, I love being in the background, which is probably why I skipped the first, the first podcast. And then it sort of freed me up to do things without like that sense of judgment. So I could play and make mistakes and like just put it out there and not worry about anything.
Yeah.
So the truth is, like, I don't know how many people actually in the ceramics world know that I do this.
Oh my gosh.
It's like a side project.
Yeah.
But I'm starting to like veer towards like making it more like a cohesive part of my overall practice, because there's definitely tons of overlap.
Yeah.
I was in a show. I sent an ashtray to an ashtray show there in Richmond. And it had those figures on it. I just posted a story in my Instagram, but, it had He-Man on it.
So wait.
I'm like coming out.
I got so many questions just about this show. So one, is it the one where the pieces are holding up the thing behind them?
Yeah, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
That was an incredible piece. I didn't know what it was. So now that you said it's an ashtray, even crazier. Two, you and I are talking about how niche the toy world is. And you just said you sent a piece to an ashtray show.
<It's> so
like that is,
ceramics is just this crazy field. Like that, I felt like, I always feel like I'm in between.
Empire.
Blister. Empire Blisters. Specializing in action figure blisters. 3.75 inch or 1/18 scale. 19 different styles. Two sizes of clamshell figure cases. Four different bulk pack options. Quantities of 100 sample packs available. Empire Blisters.
Now sponsor Toys on Tap.
That means a 10% off coupon on checkout. Use code Toys on Tap 10. That's TOYSOMTAP 10. Empire Blisters.
Like, I don't belong anywhere. Like, so ceramics isn't really accepted by as like a fine art practice. Yeah. And in some cases, people like make the leap into, you know, blue chip galleries in New York. But for the most part, it's like pushed to the craft sort of decorative arts category. Mm-hmm. And then like same with toys, like both very kind of niche and like, I don't know, in terms of like the hierarchy of whether it's like material or category, like resin toys, I might get in trouble for saying this, but they seem like they're below like designer or Sufubi or something, you know, like they're like the DIY punk rock version of it. And when you think about ceramics in comparison to like fine art or whatever, it's a little bit similar. So I always find myself in between these places, which is a good place to be, like on the fringes.
Yeah.
Because you can criticize in different ways.
What's crazy is I don't know that you would get in trouble, because I think that regardless if there's a hierarchy or not, resin is probably one of the newest, if not the newest, of all of those. Right. Yeah. Like the earliest resin toy I have is from that I know of is from 89, but we have Sufubi that has come in before that. And we have designer toys that are coming in probably around the same time, hip hop culture. So it's alongside some of those. And it doesn't, like, resin toys don't necessarily scream high end. Right. Yeah. But they take so
they
much
could,
work.
Yeah.
Yeah. They take so much work and so much like knowledge of how to do things. And you have people that are crushing it. Like I could list off so many artists that their toys are definitely high end toys, but the world probably looks at them like, okay, it's just a toy. Let's chill out, which is a bummer.
Yeah, but they're not. I mean, are they just toys? Like, none of them are just toys.
No, everything behind me is not just a toy. It is like my life in a cabinet.
Right. So, in a way, it doesn't matter what if it's resin or anything. It's like the idea and the way that it's executed.
Yeah. So you're in this this culture that is amazing, and with all these different. Like pieces of residencies and they have shows and stuff. And then the pandemic hits and somehow you get turned on to the idea of we're going to make toys now with all this knowledge that I have, we're going to turn to toys. What's the first toy you make and how did you get pushed? Like, what was the thing that kind of pushed you over the edge to secure this idea?
I mean, so I should say that when I was in Helena at the Bray, the Archie Bray, I was getting older and I felt like I needed some security. So I applied for teaching gigs. So my day job my paycheck is from teaching.
Yeah.
And that was a pretty conscious decision, you know, so that I could make what I wanted without worrying about selling it and then do the teaching side of it. But I found that teaching is a really kind of important creative part of just what I do. So it's funny, like probably more than this, 6 or 7 years ago, I was doing mold making demos in class and somebody had like a He-Man figure or part of one. And I cast it, showed them how to do it. And then it's just been sitting on my shelf for like that long.
Yeah.
And then the pandemic happened. All the shows that I was in were canceled. Any kind of like workshops or traveling that I was going to do was canceled. I had a baby. We were all stuck at home, and I had just got this studio, so everything just kind of came together, and I decided just to start playing with older things. So I was looking at my shelves. I saw that He-Man. I'm like, okay, I'm going to do this. I think I put it on eBay or something, eBay for some reason, just to like see if it would gain interest. And somebody bought it, and they are into it. And I was like, okay. So then I decided I'm just going to do all of it. Because before this, my work was a little bit more ambitious than casting figures. It was like large scale stuff. So I'm like, how can I make this small stuff into a large project? So I'm going to do all of them. I'm going to do all the toys. And then I just started doing that. And there was a point where after my daughter was born, we were stuck in the hospital because it was lockdown. I couldn't leave or, you know, come back. And then she had to have like a heart monitor thing for a while. So we were stuck in the hospital for a week, and I was just on my iPhone. I was like, I'll just start Instagram just dedicated to this project and then document it, document everything about it, or as much as I could, or as much as I could like force myself to do, because I'm not a big social media person.
Yeah.
And that's how it started. I think like 3 or 4 posts in, we were still in the hospital, and Scott Cherry was like, oh, he shared it on his Instagram. And I was like, I think I only had like 50 followers or something. And then it kind of blew up there.
Yeah.
And then it's just been kind of fun to carry on.
Yeah. Scott so coming in.
And during lockdown, I know Scott was awesome at the beginning. I was like amped on this new project. So I always have like a ton of energy when I'm doing something new, because there's tons of discovery.
Yeah.
I was going down the wormhole of resin toys and like watching podcasts and all this other stuff that everyone does. And I was on like paternity leave. So that was it. That was my time. So my wife was at home. I this was small enough that I could take, you know, small molds home and work at the dining room table. Take care of the kid, and yeah, post on Instagram where everyone else is.
Unreal. The fact that it started out as just a documenting of like your work, one screams that you're like an artist. Like, you didn't have the initial like, let's figure out how I can monetize this, but your whole process was like, we're just going to document the process and document this project. I rarely have that, and I envy those that have that, because in my head, it's like, if I want to do this, I got to make sure that I can validate myself. But to document something just for process sake is pretty admirable and, pretty like art centered, which is really cool.
Yeah. Well, I mean, having a job and a paycheck is a bit of a privilege. Like, I don't have to rely on it.
Right.
But I mean, that said, I never pushed sales, but I did end up opening an Etsy store, and you know, for the first, and it ramped up super quick. And I think that was a bit to do with my pricing. This first few months, like before, so September is when I started, and then leading up to, I guess, Christmas shopping, like all through November, it was insane. Just the number of orders, and I only had a few molds at that time.
Yeah.
And then in the new year, I'd like doubled the prices, and then I doubled it again because I just couldn't keep up. It wasn't like I was losing money.
Yeah.
And sleep. So the sales went down, which was good, but the income kind of stayed steady.
Mm-hmm.
And it was pretty interesting. It was very tied to my Instagram posts, so I could like decide how much I wanted to work based on how much I posted on Instagram. So the extra money helped a lot, and I'm super grateful to anybody who bought work.
Yeah,
they're still buying work because my Etsy is still up, although I'm going to take it down for a bit. But
is this like Toys on Tap exclusive? Like, you're just cutting it out?
I don't know how much people pay attention, but I've barely posted in the last 2 months just because of the move.
Yeah.
And then in April, I'm going to be in Italy for a month teaching there. So
that's awesome.
So I can't make Etsy sales.
Yeah. For your, I mean, it's interesting the toys that you have made. You don't stick with one like company, one brand, like you're just going. And you've made all kinds of stuff. And if I remember correct, you've also made large scale stuff. Like the He-Man Castle, or no, Castle Grayskull.
Yeah, I did that. It's so funny. Like, I'll make a mold of something and I'm like super stoked on it.
Yeah.
And that's the most interesting part. Like, can I get it? Can I make it?
Mm-hmm.
And then I make it and I'm so happy to move on and not just make them, keep making them or anything. So I know there's a ton of projects that I've started, but just haven't like put out there. One day I will.
Yeah. Which is, and you documented the, what's interesting about that, and you did it, and then you've documented Battle Cat got made, and then you've documented different Star Wars figures that got made, and at
this
some
is
point,
relatively big.
That's huge.
Guy. Yeah.
Wait,
so I got a 3D printer this summer.
Yeah.
And then printed this guy out.
That
is the only one I made so far.
Oh my gosh. What's crazy about that is the same size. So there's two giants in the Mexican bootleg market. The ugly blow mold one that's like weird. It looks like it's holding a lightsaber hilt, like crazy. And then they have one that looks like that. That's like a vinyl figure almost.
Oh, really?
It's really cool. So that's what I thought that was. But you haven't made that one. You like, well, you've made it, but haven't made it.
I printed it and I made the molds and then I cast one.
Yeah.
And then I was like, well, I did that. So I don't know. There's so much I need more time.
Yeah.
Feel that way. Like this thing. Okay. This thing I made, like Killer Bootleg sent me this guy.
Oh yeah. Yeah.
Probably two and a half years ago. And I cast them and they're sitting on my desk. And then I'm like, okay, I want to do a cool box for them. So I designed it and it's still sitting there. So like there's releases that I need to get out in the world that I just need to force myself to do.
Yeah. The He-Man one, if I could line up a buyer for you in the next couple of days, would you sell it to him? I have someone in mind that...
Go for it. Sure.
Okay. Yeah, it's interesting that you haven't stayed with one. You've made all these things. You have a giant He-Man there. You got Knuckle Duster in a custom case going. How do you decide? This is going to be a two-part. Like, how do you decide what's next? Right? Because, like, it's bigger than a collection now. Now it's like whatever we can get our hands on is what it feels like. So how are you deciding what's next?
Okay. A lot of it's determined. This has been sort of the story of my life, but a lot of it's determined by external pressures. So Etsy, I don't do drops very often. Etsy is just a shop that's on there and it's all pre-ordered. So if someone puts an order in, I'll cast it. And then I got to make it. I guess that's the pressure. Otherwise I would never make anything. I would never sell anything.
Yeah.
So that takes up a certain amount of time. And then I guess like my own curiosity, like, can I make a box for Knuckle Duster that he can also be displayed in? What does that look like? Or can I 3D print a scan of He-Man that's like five times as big? So it's like, it's sort of like trying new things is what pushes me forward. And I think it's the same with most of, you know, the makers out there.
Mm-hmm.
Nobody likes to do runs, but even like just playing with parts, like we all end up with parts and like there's that scrap show and stuff out there. So remixing bits and pieces like that Jake the Snake with the Battle Cat thing, and those just come about because there's stuff on my desk and I like put them together. And yeah.
Okay.
And it's not that complicated. Has that guy, I don't know, there's that, it makes me think about this YouTube documentary called Everything is a Remix by Kirby Ferguson. Have you heard of this?
No, I haven't.
Oh, it's worth a look. It came out like 10 years ago as a three-part series. Mm-hmm. And he takes...
We interrupt this broadcast of Toys on Tap to bring you this.
Meanwhile, in a galaxy of bootleg treasures...
DOV2, we have engine failure! We must crash land on DKE Toy Planet! Oh my! We're doomed!
Wait! Salvation! Hooray! We're saved, DOV2! Limited edition custom artist-made action figures and DKE toys!
Check out www.dketoys.com for a full catalog.
Hooray for custom action figures!
DKE!
He takes, like, popular culture, movies, music, stuff like that, and breaks it down into, like, this process of, you know, remixing. So, like, copy, combine, and transform are, like, his three components to come up with something new. And he's saying that, like, all creative acts have some sort of remixing involved. I think he just remixed his own documentary last year. So he, like, came out with a new version to address, like, memes and Instagram and AI. So
yeah, that's cool. I'll have to go look at it. I'm into documentaries that kind of overlap with what we do here in the toy scene and bootleg culture and stuff. When it comes to making these things and then getting hooked up with Dove, is that during pandemic, like right when you start, Dove sees it and he's like, give me that?
He reached out. I don't know. Yeah, the timeline's fuzzy. I'm sure it was very early on.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think that at the beginning, the work that I was posting, like, spread pretty quick amongst this crowd, like, not just random people, but, like, people who are interested in toys. So I was, Dove reached out, and then, like, Super 7, I did an edition of their Mummy Boys in porcelain.
Wow.
General Giant, I did stuff. And then some other, like, NDA things, like, editions and commissions that I took on that I never would have done before, but the money was good. And then it was also something new.
Yeah.
I learned a lot about running, like, a business.
Yeah. Cause that's crazy that you hate it. Yeah. That's the cry of the artist is like, we just want to make, but don't, like, the business side is the worst side of all of this.
Well, and making work for other people and other people's ideas just didn't do it for me.
Yeah.
And then not getting credit because it was all non-disclosure stuff. I'm like, I don't know.
That stuff is crazy.
Not satisfying.
Yeah. I don't understand companies that do that. And a lot of companies do that. And I just...
It's money, right? Yeah. I don't know. There's so many layers involved with that. Like, yeah, the making additions and stuff. That I'm just not involved with it. It's very commercial based. Like, so artists that are really famous do farm out work all the time. It's normal. Yeah. I don't want to be on that end of it. I don't want to make other people's work.
Yeah.
But if people do, like, people have skills and they want to apply them in that way, then cool. That's awesome.
Yeah. Have you heard of the artist Matt Gondek?
Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. He's been on here before and we talked. I mean, he made a Sufubi, so we kind of talked just toys. But I listened to his podcast called Clean Break, and he had an artist that had come on, and he does this, what we do here for toys, he does for art and business and stuff. And I shouldn't say for art and business, I should say for, like, artists and business. But he, yeah, like, talked about how he has a team that sometimes he doesn't want to do certain things, and he has someone on his team that can paint a circle. It's just one color. Oh, yeah. Or, like, and then he'll come out and do the outline. That doesn't bother me as the person that would consume his art, but it bothers a different part of me that's like, oh, I don't know that I am at that. I'm definitely not at that point where I could do that. But also, do you not miss it? Are there parts of you, yeah, that don't miss that circle? I don't know.
Oh, man. Sometimes labor is just time wasted. Yeah. Like, it's like you don't learn anything from it. It doesn't contribute to the piece.
Right.
So having someone else do it is fine. And then other times, collaborating with people that have skills that you don't have is necessary. We all do it. Yeah. There's no way that I'll learn everything,
yeah,
that I want to do.
One day.
One day, but yeah. I feel like, so you mentioned Dove reaching out, and that was cool because it's almost like he gave me an assignment.
Mm-hmm.
So I have this like problem that I need to figure out. How am I going to be in the show that does this certain thing? And that's where those sort of porcelain backed figures came from.
Yeah. What was the first one for Dove? Was it Leia?
It was Princess. It was the Leia.
Yeah. I remember seeing it the first time and it was like, holy hell. Like this is, because it doesn't take, from what I understand, which is so little about your work, is that it's not like with ceramics, especially, like you don't paint it. If you're going to put a color, you glaze it a certain color, correct?
That's what I do. I mean, you can paint them, but I leave it white.
Yeah. And the shininess is amazing. And it cuts out a piece of the process that I hate anyways. Like I hate the painting part anyway. So that's awesome. And I remember seeing it and thinking the initial time was like, okay, like this is moving into a like gallery setting feeling. Because not like I saw that one. Did you do a Vader on the intricate one?
Yeah, I did. I did black porcelain Vader.
Yep.
Yeah. So these were all, and it was called Lord. So porcelain in the hierarchy of like ceramic materials, porcelain is considered like the most high end, like precious sort of aristocratic.
Yeah.
I guess, material.
Look at you.
Right?
Look at you.
So that tie to like 18th century, 17th century Baroque and Rococo decorative arts and figurines. I mean, they had porcelain figurines back then all over the place, is what I was like trying to merge with the toy packaging.
Okay.
So, yeah. So the idea of like taking the princess and the Lord, and then maybe I'll do an emperor at some point where they're like, they have aristocratic titles.
Yeah.
So it kind of made sense. So it's like, I called it the aristocratic galactic aristocrat series. I can't remember.
Yeah. Like that. And then do you, with this, my assumption is that because of your skill set, sculpting and the pouring and mold making isn't necessarily the hardest part, but it's the packaging to make sure that like when it's in there, it's stable. Is it because it's a glass top that goes over it, right?
Yeah. Leia was glued down, and then I figured out a magnet system.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah. That was always
so that was tricky. Like, how do I do the bubble? How do I do that, the blister pack in ceramic? Yeah.
Which is insane. And you nailed it with like these pieces, and then you've made an R2 that's in its own, like, little bubble around it. And I think it's C-3PO, correct?
Yeah, he was a bit of an outlier, but yeah, I did C-3PO with like little chunks from the Millennium Falcon, like robotic kind of like machine stuff.
And so these are all intricate, incredible pieces of work. I've seen some of them go through Dove's shows, and I've seen them in person, which is crazy. At the last decon, I'm standing there and then you saying something to me, but not ever having seen your face, and just it didn't click who you were. And it was like, I was just running through my head. It was like a Rolodex in my brain, just trying to figure out like, okay, who are we? And then you said who you were. I was like, awesome. Let's do this.
A different one, but the crumpled paper one was kind of just the fun.
Because that's next and how I want it. Like, you took something that is so ugly, like the fact that someone would crumple up a backer or would like destroy an action figure or it would be buried away is a very ugly thing. Like, it's just heartbreaking that would happen. And you took that and made something out of this like high-end ceramic material, and you documented it. So the process is there. The one part that I haven't seen how you did was the blister part. So I definitely want to see how that happens. But like, the backer was an insane thing, that watching you do that and watching those videos. And then the piece that, if I remember right, it comes out, like you can like somehow wiggle it out of there.
Yeah.
And then getting it to say Star Wars and all those things, and walk me through that. I mean, I had Whistling Pony on, so he makes me now think of art more critically, or like look past certain things. And I think when I saw that, it was like, oh, you made beauty out of like what is hot garbage at this point. Because if that's an original figure, you can't grade it. You can't do anything. And you took it and made some beauty. So tell me about that process and like why that was what you chose. Because that was insane.
Oh, God. I mean, I don't know. It wasn't planned out. So it started as an experiment.
Yeah.
Actually, it started as seeing a post by this guy, Mr. Stevie. Mm-hmm. He works for like Hasbro.
Yeah.
And a long time ago, he posted an idea where he would just like collect all these images of packages that have been ripped open.
Mm-hmm.
And there is something about like that ripping where you're like destroying it, but then it's becoming something new.
Yeah.
That I really liked. Like, I like that object that was a bit crumpled and used and had history and had been through this action. So I was curious about how, like, how I could apply that to my work. And in a way, I think about like casting as a almost like a taking a photograph, like a three-dimensional photograph.
Yeah.
You know, so it traps that moment in time, mm-hmm. in a way. The same way that a photograph does, and it preserves it. So it sort of freezes it in that moment. And that's kind of what I wanted to do. I wanted to take that sort of that garbage, transform it. So by altering the material and turn it precious, but yeah. then retain that quality of like this action happening, like this crumpling.
Yeah.
And have those all kind of merge together and see what happened. And then in the form of a toy packaging, I think it just fit in with the context.
So. What's cool is seeing it on there, like seeing it next to all the figures, because it makes you double take when it's on the table with Dove. Like if something is beat up and it's still out on yeah. the table, you're like, what the hell are we doing here? But that yeah. was intentionally designed to be that way. And seeing it, your pieces, like I'll lift up any of those pieces that if Dove says I can pick them up, I'll pick them up. Your work is the only work I won't. I won't even like reach for it. I don't have the capacity.
That's funny because I mean, don't you, we all have to touch stuff. And I feel like ceramics is one of those materials that is just so hard to restrain yourself from.
That's it's grabbing it. Yeah. I just also know how expensive ceramics is. And like, and so it's like, if I drop a $60 toy, that's easier to tell my wife, like, hey, I paid for a $60 toy. It's harder to say, like, I dropped a $400 work of art. My bad. Not only do we get to pay for it, but we don't get to bring it home. Yeah. So, but it was cool seeing that.
I like that.
Yeah.
I like that Whistling Pony. Sorry to cut you off. That interview you did was pretty interesting. It was good to see.
Yeah,
I mean, I wasn't familiar with that work before.
Yeah, he talks over my head.
I mean, I had seen it, but I didn't spend a lot of time like trying to figure it out. So
yeah,
this recent. Did you see the recent piece that they did with
yep.
the shard of like the plate? Like,
yeah,
oh, that's awesome.
I haven't reached out to him yet. It's on the like on the to do list of like. Because when we talked about the idea that he wants to put in the blister what you see on the packaging. And yeah. the blister yeah. is a broken plate. And he, man, I can't, is this one of his trite sublimates or sublimites? I don't think it is. I think it's something different.
I don't know. I don't think it is. I think it's a new thing.
Yeah. He, between those and then doing this kind of work, it takes a back seat or it makes his Jenny project go to the back seat. But this stuff is like, it's interesting. I think yeah. that work and then your crumpled blister and packaging work, it makes people look at toys differently, which is very helpful for a scene that is still in its infancy.
Yeah.
Because yeah, if we consistently only make, resin toys, which please everyone keep making those. I'll buy them. I have shelving that needs space or needs toys. But if we only ever made the same things, I don't know that it would grow as much, but it's like these new techniques, these new styles, all this stuff is coming together and it's insane. It's insane to see how much this scene has grown even since I've been in it in only 4 years.
Yeah. It's fun to watch.
Yeah.
It's fun
so,
to be part of. Yeah.
Yeah. And so, I mean, the question that I have to ask every artist which I really love asking this question because it's kind of funny watching artists kind of squirm a little bit too, of like, you have done all this work in porcelain and you have knocked it out of the park and continued to do nothing but great work. And it has been incredible to watch it. What's next for you?
Oh man, I mean, there's so many things. I appreciate that. Thanks for saying that.
Yeah.
Does make me squirm.
Yeah.
There's like no end of ideas, but the more kind of recent direction that I've wanted to go is to back off on sales and like singular figures, you know, is to mash them up with more sort of that 18th century Baroque decorative stuff that I've started to do, kind of like with the packaging for the toys. But then like build like an exhibition scale, like work towards a show.
Yeah.
You know? Yeah.
Like your own show, a solo gallery?
It would make sense to have it all cohesive as like one solo show.
Okay.
So that's sort of this year is what I've been doing. And I've been, you know, I've cast trash in porcelain before. Like I've done series of like old milk cartons that get thrown away, or like broken styrofoam and stuff. And that idea of like taking something cheap and then making it precious has always been interesting to me. And there's this whole, and this is sort of, I get these things from these like decorative plastic cheap.
Yeah, like a sconce almost.
Yeah, it's like a sconce that's supposed to be in Versailles, you know?
Yeah.
It has like gold spray paint on it and it's super cheesy and tacky. So I've been collecting these like at thrift shops and on eBay and stuff as a way to display kind of still life groupings of figures, because they kind of get lost, you know, on a pedestal or a plinth on their own. It's funny, seeing them on your phone or on Instagram where I can frame them and really decide how you see them is one thing. But once they're like sitting in the middle of a room, they kind of get lost a little bit. So,
yeah.
So I'm thinking about pushing that more, like that combination of the 18th century and then the plastic toy nostalgia stuff, and seeing where it goes.
Man, it's crazy, because I would love to see art shows are phenomenal. Let me rephrase that. I love art shows when it's art that I enjoy seeing. I feel like that's a good way to say that.
Sometimes contemporary art can feel super inaccessible. You know, like they're like the artist is trying to like pull one over on you. Like,
yeah.
Well, yeah. So in a way, this gives like multiple entry points for people. I feel like like anybody can associate with it or understand it in different ways, depending on their background or history. Yeah.
The thing that, I mean, you brought it up, so now I get to say, like, what irritates me is the inaccessibility sometimes. Like, if you're going to hang up a canvas that's plain white with nothing on it, that's fine.
Yeah.
You call it art. Anything can be art. I'll buy into that. But give me an entry point. Like, I can't have it be, it is what you say it is. Nope. Because I'm a cynic when it comes to that. So it is garbage to me. And so I need you to help me get to the point that, and so I think that's what makes it inaccessible. I went to an exhibit and it was, each canvas was one of two things. One, it was one solid color and that was the whole thing, or the opposite of it. It was just one shape that was fully filled in on a giant canvas, and all of it was inaccessible for me. And so it was like, I spent my time. I really watched it and looked at it, but it was tough.
Sometimes there's a story behind those that you just need to know.
Yeah.
It makes me think, like, so you mentioned this before, like artwork that changes the way you see the world or you think about the world or understand it has value to you. And I agree. Like, that's like one of the ways I judge art is like how it affects me and my perception of the world. And a lot of the toy artists that I follow have done that. Like Magoob is like constantly doing that. When I was an art student, I would flip through art magazines and there was this one photo of like just this black giant rectangle on the floor.
Yeah.
And I was like, this is, I don't get it. Like it's published in like one of the best art magazines in the States. It's getting all this critical review. So just looking at the picture, didn't get it. Reading the article, even just reading the title, flipped a switch and then my understanding of the piece really changed. So it was the casting that is by an artist named Rachel White Reed, who's a British artist.
Mm-hmm.
It was the casting of a space underneath a bed.
Mm.
And if you look close, it retains all of the information like of the bottom of the mattress, sort of has a little bit of slumping, a little bit of stitching and stuff, but it's painted black. So it's like this void. And I just thought like making that space physical, tangible, and then like all these other associations of what's hiding under the bed. There's like this mystery, there's monsters, there's all the stuff that if you don't know what it is or where it's from, you just don't have a full understanding. So context and understanding like that background stuff for certain artworks is so important.
Yeah.
And she actually influenced my whole direction to go into like mold making and casting.
That's awesome.
She did this piece that you might like. It was a public art piece where she went inside a house. It was the last house on this block in London of row houses. She sprayed concrete up against the walls of the house.
Mm-hmm.
So it stuck to the walls, hardened, and then she pulled the walls away. So it was like, it looked like the solid interior shape of this house.
Okay.
It's such a crazy idea, but for some reason, just like that gesture became like super symbolic for a number of reasons. And it was tied to like a lot of memory and other things too. So
I like that.
That was a long rant about
no, that's good.
And sculpture. And
I think there are certain art forms that I've kind of written off because of like the lack of understanding almost. It's like, you know, where they put one canvas on the ground and they spin like a paint bucket and it like does things.
Oh yeah.
Write
that off.
Yeah. I'm more than happy to say that's art. Go ahead. I am also more than happy to say I'm uninterested in that because I can't access the meaning, depth, or anything about it. And it looks like child's play. But that's okay. Like, I think that's what makes art art. The fact that I can think it's that.
But that's why, I mean, that thing is like made for Instagram. It's all about the process and the wow and like the aesthetics.
It's hotel
like
art.
It's like tied to, what's that, zombie formalism? Have you heard of that term?
Yeah.
It's just a way to critique like abstract artists that don't really have a lot behind it.
The ones that I have found that drive me nuts too are interactive. There's two that have been like, man, I cannot remember her name, which is a bummer. But there's two interactive pieces that I like. The second I saw them, I started connecting with it, and I was like, oh my God, like this is unreal. There's one, Yo-Yo Dine is doing an Instagram of it on a separate Instagram where it's like
Marina Abramovich.
There we go.
Yeah.
So there's two things that she's done.
That was famous. That piece is like,
where you can, you could go wait and then sit in front of her. I think because for me personally, that's a very healing thing for a lot of people to be in the presence of someone else and not talk. It's like practicing the ritualistic part of like religion sometimes and the healing part of, like psychology of just being silent and with people. So that was like, wow, like we're doing this, we're the culture. She also had an image where it was a bow and arrow and someone was like pulling it back and falling. And then they had, which is like, again,
oh God. That's so, it's like full of tension. Yeah, it's scary.
So those two from that artist, and then there was another one that did this thing where she was standing at a table, all these weapons and stuff, and like all these pens, and it was like, you can do whatever you want to me from whatever's on this table. And it started the progression of what happened was the scariest part. Is like, it started out with a feather and like tickling her face and goofy stuff. And then by the end of the day, she had been stripped and like hit and written on, and someone held a gun into her face. And it was for me, that just speaks of like the downfall of society. The second you say one thing is okay, it just like, where is it going at this weird slope? And so most of the time, interactive artists and stuff, I don't want to go be a part of it. But those two, that was insane.
Yeah, it's hard. I mean, I know people that really are interested in interactive art, and I've done pieces that have been interactive too. Getting the audience to participate is a trick. It's hard.
Yeah. They participate without knowing it. Those are fun.
Oh, that's funny. Yeah.
Yeah. With all that, I mean, it's been such a blast to talk to you on the podcast, and it was worth the wait. I'm happy you finally got on. I know that you're leaving for a month, but like really soon, but it's still helpful to plug where they can find you, if you'll take commissions after this month, where they can get your work, all that stuff.
I mean, Instagram is the place. That's where we all are. So Recollection Toys. And I post there as much as I can.
Yeah.
So if you're interested in that, find me there. I don't really have anything to plug. I'm looking forward to maybe. So I'm going to Italy to teach a puppet making workshop. So something might grow out of that. Maybe I'll start doing puppets.
Awesome.
On a separate Instagram.
Yeah.
If I have, I have an Etsy shop linked to there, but no pressure, because I think I have like 100% late shipping rating on there. Like nothing goes out on time. So
yeah.
Apologies to anybody who's bought stuff, and thank you for your patience.
Yeah. Dude.
So that'll be up. And then I'm going to try and get some of these pieces, like the editions that I started. I have a Jabba the Hutt. I got the Knuckle Duster. I really want to get those out when I come back.
Yeah. Dude, it's been awesome having you on. Thank you for coming on Toys on Tap.